Hello, everyone, and welcome to Season 4 of The Hidden Lives of Writers. My name's Fiona Snickers, and I'm joined by my co-host, Gail Schimmel.
Fiona, can you believe it is Season 4? Because I can't.
You know, I can, because we have worked very hard at these.
True.
And we have lived through every episode. But I'm just so delighted that we've got this far, and I think we are starting the season very strongly.
An amazing lineup to start this season. It's very exciting. Fiona, before we can start that amazing lineup, how has your writing week been?
Well, you know, I've been busy with a lot of different commitments related to writing festivals and launches and that kind of thing. So it's been kind of bitty, but I somehow, by the skin of my teeth, have managed to meet my writing commitments for each week. I've managed to slam those words together and work my 5 days a week and take weekends off. So I've managed to stick to it, and I'm feeling rather proud of myself about that.
Rightly so. I'm very impressed.
Gail, I noticed you are looking rather tanned and relaxed. I think you have been on holiday. Did you manage to write while you were away?
I did. It was quite a relief to me. Holidays are, ironically, my best working time for writing. And I was able to write 1,000 words a day.
Wow.
And enjoy myself doing it and feel inspired by the plot and feel excited that actually one day I will finish this book, which has not been feeling likely. And then I got sick and stopped writing. But it has been a good writing experience. Writing on holiday again has made me wish a little bit that my life was a holiday.
What is it about being on holiday that works so well for you? Is it the break from the day job?
You know, it is that simple, that I have time. So it's the break from the day job, but also a break from my children's school demands, the taking to school, the fetching from school, the balancing. It's a break from the balancing. Mm. And that really, the holiday we were on, it's in a hotel that, you know, where the children can run around as they wish to. They are old enough that they're safe, more or less. And it's a time off life, and I can indulge in the feeling of being a full-time writer. And it's quite a nice feeling. And I'm relieved that it's still there.
And that holiday writing, does it happen throughout the day, or is there a particular time that you push it into?
I make myself get it done, so that I can then get in on with, because it is also my holiday, and I can then go and lie by the pool or do whatever we're doing for the day. Normally it's about mid-morning that I sit down and I write the 1,000 words, and I'm not allowed up until I've written the 1,000 words. And then I know I can, it's probably what you experience every day of, now I can get on with my day. I have done the writing. I can put that aside. I can take that feeling of creativity and achievement and take that with me into the rest of the day and do the other things.
Well, that sounds absolutely lovely. And you're right. It is, I'm at a stage in my life where I have that on most days. And at the moment, I'm looking forward to things getting a bit less busy so I can get back into that very relaxed space.
And have you, with all that busyness, had time to read or consume anything?
In terms of things that I have enjoyed greatly, a Netflix show, which was the latest season of True Detective. It's called True Detective Night Country with Jodie Foster, and it was absolutely magnificent. I think in the last season, Ron Irwin mentioned it on the podcast, and I paid attention and went and watched it. He said, and I've heard other people say, that he found it very confusing at first. The plot seems confusing initially. You're not too sure what's going on. I was aware of that going in, so I wasn't expecting to be fully up to speed immediately. And I must say, I didn't find it confusing. I was just very much aware that I did not know everything yet. It kind of drip feeds you information. But it's a setting that I love. It's up in the far north. They've just entered into winter time, so it's night. The sun won't rise now for several months. It's nighttime all the time. And there's been a murder, a mass murder apparently. Well, people are dead. We're not sure how it came about. It's being investigated. Jodie Foster's character is absolutely great, and I would highly, highly recommend it.
Is it dark the whole time in the story?
It's dark, but, you know, they're indoors for a lot of the time. So because they're indoors, you know, there's artificial light all the time. And even when they're out on the street, there are street lights. So it's not like you kind of peering at the screen, okay, wondering what's going on. But yes, the sun never rises and never sets. It's just dark the whole time. And you can see that it's starting to affect people a bit.
Interesting, because it's a particular dislike of mine. I don't like dark TV. I don't like watching a dark show. I like a well-lit show.
No, this is very well-lit, but you're just aware that it's dark outside all the time. And Gail, what have you been reading or watching or listening to?
So Fiona, because we've been doing this podcast for a while, I'm not 100% sure if I've ever mentioned this before. Mm-hmm. But I want to talk about a podcast that I listen to. It's called Heavyweight, and it's hosted by Jonathan Goldstein.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the first podcast I ever listened to, and it's a podcast I still enjoy. And it is stories of people who have been carrying around a weight, and then they ask Jonathan Goldstein to help them solve their problem in some ways. And it's very gentle stories.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I'm bringing it up here is because for me, it is a masterclass in the art of storytelling. He creates almost often a story out of nothing and tells the most wonderful, gripping story in such a clever way. The structure of the podcast is so clever. And I'm in a new season of it. I don't know if it actually is new or if I just came to it late, but I'm enjoying it so much and I keep it as a treat for myself. So a treat of perfectly told story, Heavyweight with Jonathan Goldstein, cannot recommend highly enough.
Yes, you know, I tried it. It was also, I think, the first podcast I ever listened to. And I got through a couple of episodes, but I believe I should stick with it and go back to it. I think it gets better.
I think possibly the latest season, I think he's really honed his craft.
Mm-hmm.
I will look up when we finished recording. There's one I particularly enjoyed, and maybe you can put it in the show notes for us, where I actually tweeted, "This is a masterclass in storytelling."
Well, someone else who is here to give us a masterclass in storytelling and has really honed her craft is our guest today. Our guest today is Barbara Boswell. Barbara is an academic, a writer, and a feminist. She is currently a visiting scholar at Wolfson College in Oxford, working under the Oxford Centre for Life Writing. Her books include an academic work, "And Wrote My Story Anyway, Black South African Women Novels as Feminism." Also, "Grace, a Novel," which was published by Majaji Books in 2017. And now most recently, "The Comrade's Wife," published by Jacana. It's out this year. Barbara, we are so happy to have you in studio. Hello and welcome.
Hi, Fiona and Gail. Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Barbara, we're going to throw you right in the deep end, as we always do. How has your writing week been?
Oh, what writing week? I haven't had one. I've been traveling. I just came from the Franschhoek Literary Festival, which was wonderful. And I arrived yesterday in Johannesburg. So I've been doing a lot of media and publicity work for the book. And because I'm not in my space and in my home, I don't have really a setup to write. But, you know, now that I think about it, what a poor excuse, because I have my laptop. But I haven't written anything creatively this week. Lots of emails, but nothing else.
I'm interested that you talk about the space for writing, and you actually said something just before we started recording about working in a good space. Is that really important for you, that you're in a happy space in order to be creative?
It actually isn't that important, because I felt like my best writing that I did, or my most productive, was when I was a PhD student and I had a library carrel and it didn't have a window. So I could not see anything. The carrel was the size of a shower cubicle.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great because it had no distractions. And when I went in there, I was just in work mode. So I don't necessarily need a pretty space and a view even distracts me. So it's best for me, I found, to be looking at a wall. And that allows my imagination to roam a bit, because when I'm sitting at a window and I'm seeing stuff, I'm like, oh, what's going on there? And I can just, I'm easily distractible. So, but I need to be comfortable, at least a comfortable chair or a bed.
And what does your writing process look like when you are creating a novel? How many words a day? What time of day? That kind of thing.
Yeah. So I'm quite a rigid, formulaic person, and I think I found a formula that works for me. So when I have a project, it's usually my best writing time is I start at 5 a.m. I've tried different things, but that works because I know, and I aim for 1,000 words at a time. And often, you know, that's quite doable for me, and it doesn't feel overwhelming. And I often stop before I have 1,000. And when it's a good day, I maybe go to 2,000. But I've learned not to also beat myself up about not reaching that target. And when I've done 800 or even 600 words, it's okay. You've got it in for the day. And that is more important than a binge. It's being consistent and being consistently sitting and working on it. So there have been times when I'm in this routine where I write two sentences and I do feel bad about it. But then I tell myself, well, you've made progress on your manuscript. And that's what's important, not the quantity of the words. So I'm also gentle with myself as a critic, because that critic is in my head all the time that we all have, and I've learned to deal with them.
That's very good advice, to be gentle with oneself. I'm writing it down quickly.
Barbara, tell us about your work at the Centre for Life Writing at Oxford. What project are you working on there? How did it come about? And is it proving to be a great space for writing or planning?
Okay, that's been, it's a short fellowship, so I've chosen only to go for one term, which is 2 months. I had to write a proposal for the project that I want to do, and the project involves my grandmother's journals. So I have had a very close relationship with my grandmother, who died at the age of 91. She was born in 1922. And she started traveling when she was 51. It's funny because I'm 51 now. And she wrote these travel blogs, travel journals. And some of the entries are very mundane. Like, I had fish for lunch and the temperature was 19 degrees Celsius. But she goes to Paris, to Europe, all over Europe, London, Vienna, Japan, Israel, Bangkok.
And around what time? When is this in history?
It starts in the 70s. The journals start in 1973. And so it's just fascinating to me as a record, a black woman, a South African black woman, colored woman, who lives under apartheid, but then goes and she seems clearly living her best life abroad and having these parties and drinking champagne. And, you know, her part of it is with my grandfather, but he died quite young. And so then, you know, when he died, she says, oh, I will have to travel alone from now on. And she just continues. So it's fascinating for me. And I wrote a proposal about it, and I'm writing, I think it's an essay, or maybe, I don't know if it's a book. I don't know if there's enough there, but it's been really great to be at the Oxford Centre for Life Writing, because so far I've gone to 2 presentations where people are working on materials from their grandmother's lives.
Oh, wow.
And so it's fascinating. And I also then I have this muse mentor, Betty Govinden, the academic, who's I think she's in her 80s now, but she's written a lot of pioneering work on South African women's writing and South African Indian women's writing. And so I've been in touch with her for years because I read her work and I follow her model, I think, with And Wrote My Story Anyway. Her book was actually the blueprint for me. Her book is called Sister Outsider. So I was just WhatsApping her and said, I'm at Oxford and I'm writing about my grandmother and I'm so excited. And then she sent me all these essays that she wrote about her grandmother. and how to theorize this relationship. And as academics, we always want to be theorizing, but I also just want to tell a story about her. And, you know, I think she was quite a unique person. I think we all think, you know, our family members are unique, but there's a story there that I want to tell, and I'm working on it. And, we sit in seminars. We have a weekly seminar and critique each other's work. So that's a very generative space to be in also.
It sounds amazing. It's so interesting that thing about writing about grandmothers, that there's so many people doing it. It sounds, Barbara, like it's a move. Your previous novels have dealt with quite difficult topics of abuse and difficult relationships and real world problems. It sounds like this is a turn for the gentler, drinking champagne as one travels around Europe. How's yeah. that been for you?
You know, the first trip that she took was on a cruise liner. So before she even went to Europe, she went on a cruise to Mozambique, and she had the most fantastic time.
So from what I understand, in those days, going to LM was like, you just did have a wonderful time yeah. and a wild time.
So I am trying to look for opportunities to write more about joy and pleasure and
lovely.
People having a good time instead of these really dark topics that also attract me. So yes, and then I also think I'm working on a novel, another novel, and she's also going to be somewhat of a blueprint for a character that I've just started developing, but obviously it's not going to be her, but somehow she's the animating spirit in this one little character who's a 7-year-old girl who I'm working on at the moment.
Wonderful. I want to go back now to Grace and Novel and talk about your decision to tell the story through Grace's eyes and also through the eyes of her father, Patrick, the abuser, and literally how he feels as he is living his life and doing these things that he knows are wrong, the sort of thought processes behind it and the way we see him on the page through his own eyes, lose control, feel sorry, determined to do better, lose control again. What were you doing by giving voice to the abuser like that? Was it to help us understand him?
Yeah, what an interesting question. I think, yes, partly it was, but I also think, first of all, I'm writing for myself often and for me to make sense of things. And I've said elsewhere that the whole experience of Grace, the childhood experience was my experience, really. The novel is fiction, but those scenes and the growing up with an abusive male father, was my experience. And so I think part of me was also trying to understand him and how I have a lot of empathy for him now, despite all of the damage that he did, which was substantial and significant. But I could see the struggle. I saw that struggle in him and wanting to be better and trying to be better and doing better and for a while and then just slipping into whatever demons had a hold of him, which was one of them was addiction and the other, I think, was undiagnosed some mental health issues that today would probably be diagnosed. But I think it was understanding and trying to creates for myself an understanding of why would a person do this? Because when I wrote that novel, I had had a child. I'd become a mother. And I think my son was maybe around 8 when I started writing it. And I could, you know, every day I would look at this child and think, I can't imagine doing anything to harm you. Because the protective instinct is so strong in a parent, in a healthy parent, I think. And what was it that made my father lose such control? And, you know, what were the things that really drove him? Because I know he felt terrible about it, and I know that he didn't want to do it, but it was as if some other subterranean processes were going on. And I guess that was part of me trying to understand and make peace with it.
You, on your website, talk about the healing power and the transformative power of writing. Mm-hmm. And listening to you speak, I can hear how it, for Grace, it definitely was part of it. How much is that part of the writing process for you?
You know, I am very addicted to writing. So I'm sure many writers say this, the morning pages and journaling, and I've been doing them for years to the point I have now arthritis in my one hand. And I think the morning pages is part of why, because it's just these fingers here. And that hold the pen. And so, but that, for me, journaling has been just foundational in maintaining my mental health, in helping me to be a better person, in being balanced. I also have done a lot of therapy, but the writing of the journaling for me is really, really important, because when I haven't journaled for a few days, and this is, I'm in that space now, and my journal, oh my gosh, I forgot my journal in Cape Town. Oh no. I was immediately go buy a new journal.
Yes,
but it's just very important for me. It settles me. It calms me. It helps me just to be, okay, what do I need to do? How do I need to move in the world now? And it helps me reflect on when I've been, you know, what you did wasn't cool. And it's that kind of just reflective thing. But it's also then generates material for my creative writing. And I'll also journal. If I'm starting a new project, I'll journal specifically on the topic. Okay. That so that then becomes a kind of a workbook. So I think, you know, but I teach creative writing sometimes at UCT when I feel like it. And I'm very fortunate because they let me teach whatever I want to. And so I always tell students, do not come in to heal. Don't write your thing to heal yourself, because writing, unless you're doing other things that are really taking care of yourself, if you're not ready, that writing of a traumatic thing could re-traumatize you. So you have to be at a place where you've got enough distance from, if you're writing about traumatic, your own life traumas that have occurred, you've got to be sort of a good distance away from it already to be able to properly write about it without reopening the wound. So I think it's, I'm very careful about writing as healing. I don't believe that it's automatically something that can heal us.
And I'm interested, how much of the healing is in, because you do private writing and you do public writing. Your journaling is private. Your creative writing projects become public. Mm-hmm. How much is that process of publication part of the transformation and the healing, or is that an aside for you?
You know, I don't, it's a funny thing, because it's really nice to be published and other people seeing worth and value in your work. But when it gets to this stage where I am with this book, it's very uncomfortable, in a way, because I don't want to talk about it. But, you know, when it's done, when I've written a thing, I'm ready to move on. You know, I finished the first draft of The Comrade's Wife a year ago. And I'm in a different headspace, and now I have to talk about it. And I also have to talk about it in, you know, you have to do sort of a sales pitch as a writer. Mm. You have to, that sounds terrible, but
that's exactly what it is, though.
It is. Yeah. You know, and you have to, and I can't say I hated it and it sucked and, you know, I drank a lot while I did it, but, which I didn't, but.
And she doesn't hate it and it doesn't suck.
Right. But, you know, it's messy and you have to you have to present a kind of I sat every day at 5 o'clock and it, a story, even the story has to have a nice, clean storyline. So I'm working on becoming that kind of writer who talks easily about my work.
Well, let's get into something a bit ugly and messy now, which is a theme that I noticed in both Grace and The Comrade's Wife. The damage that apartheid did to black men, the trauma it inflicted on them. And in many ways, the way these abusive men in your books act can be traced back to the damage that has been done to them and the trauma that's been inflicted on them. But you point subtly to the idea that black women have equally been damaged and traumatized by apartheid, but don't behave in the same kind of reprehensible or damaging way. Why do you think that is? Do you have any theories about why men have the freedom to act out and women have to kind of hold it together?
Ooh, I wish I had the answer to that question. It's something that we talk about a lot in my friend circle and even with my mother, you know, with other women. 'Cause we see behaviors that are just so problematic. And I mean, I think women also behave badly in different ways, but mm-hmm. I think, that the way in which, so I study gender as a, that's my academic work and constructions of gender. And I think the way in which we've constructed masculinity, in this country, it comes from the colonial period. It comes from histories of enslavement where, men who were enslaved were so emasculated and they were such a threat that they were really, you know, tortured and brutalized, and women were tortured and brutalized also, but in different ways. And then we have apartheid. It's just a heaping on of more. We you know, a very violent society, and we're in this post-apartheid era. But we haven't dealt with the trauma of that and the intergenerational trauma that is the result. You know, the tot system that originates in slavery. This is why so-called colored people, we have high addiction rates. But that was part of how we were controlled by alcohol in starting in the 1700s, the tot system started. And we still have the tot system in the Cape, you know, it's outlawed, but I think informally, it still goes on. And, so there's this making of addicts. Trauma is a gateway to addiction in all the trauma literature that I've, or addiction rather. Yeah. Trauma is the gateway to addiction. Mm. You know, I've read that in a lot of trauma literature, and Gabor Mate, I've read a lot of his work. And I think this is why, and then men are supposed to prove themselves in certain ways. And we also have in the Cape, especially this proliferation of this gang network and different gangs. And these are like alternative military structures where masculinities are built and forged and a type of masculinity is made. And then, you know, I think just patriarchy and having to be a man and having to be a man in a certain way and prove yourself as a man and what it does it mean to be a successful man. One of the words that I'm very interested in that I use to describe Neil in this novel is grootman. And it's a word I've started hearing only about maybe in the last 10 years. Mm. And it's very indicative of our ideas of what is masculinity. A grootman is someone who's important, who's respected, who holds a lot of clout. Mm. I don't mean social media clout.
Possibly but, too.
Yes, maybe. But someone with gravitas and who has influence and stature in the world. And I think that because, apartheid has really thwarted that having of gravitas and status for many black men. And so I think, you know, one possible theory, I'm not saying this is the answer, but in order to feel powerful, then violence becomes one of the ways in which one becomes powerful in your own psyche. Just a theory. I don't know. I'm not a psychologist.
You've made me think about something which is, and I wonder if this adds on to it, that what we haven't done is we haven't created jobs. And mm-hmm. jobs are one of the ways that you give people dignity.
Yes.
And for men particularly, that dignity of work is really, it seems more important to them. I'm not sure why, but it does seem more integral to their sense of self as a provider.
I agree with you. Yeah, we're sitting with an unemployment crisis. And so that feeds into that, you know, that no sense of purposelessness. And then also the very real deprivation, that not having a job, the poverty, the not having food, you know, that these are all just like a cauldron of really negative elements in which I think especially young boys or boys at the moment are being made into men. And, you know, it's someone, a journalist asked me, do you hate men? And I don't hate men.
Goodness.
I don't hate anybody really, but I wouldn't hate a category of person just based on gender. And I love many men. I like many men and I love men and I have a son and I'm invested in men being good because I think, you know, it's just better for everyone when half of the population is functional and more better and kinder and
also you do seem
healthy.
You seem to approach the issue with empathy and with a wanting to understand, not a wanting to judge.
I think so. Yes. I don't know. I hope so. I've also just in this novel captured a lot of the discourse that I hear and conversations that I have with friends about their relationships with men and a lot of things that I see on Twitter about male-female relationships. So I try to blend all of that in this novel.
And you mentioned that women don't always behave well. And a theme in both your novels is women as agents of patriarchy, especially an older generation of women who try to resist the younger generation becoming too transgressive or trying to break out of patterns of abuse. The older women seem to function as brakes, saying, no, stay in the situation. No, don't leave. No, try to be better. Mm-hmm. And a certain amount of victim blaming. Is that something that interests you, women acting as agents of patriarchy?
You know, it's coincidental that comes out. And at another book launch, someone took me to task and said, why are the mothers and the older women so poorly portrayed? And someone else then said, you know, it's mothers, again, took it back to slavery, that mothers of enslaved mothers of enslaved children were perhaps harsh to protect them because the punishments were so severe. I mean, we see like Yvette Christiance's work on, in Unconfessed where the woman kills her son, the enslaved woman. And that was quite prevalent in the Cape because there was from the slave lodge, they used to pick up babies that were born and their necks were wrung and they were thrown into a ditch. You see, I'm going to dark places again. but so if one traces the history, and I am interested in the patriarchal dividend that many women do draw from, and I think, you know, I'm very educated and I'm very privileged in that way because I've done a master's in women's and gender studies and my PhDs in gender studies. So but for people generally, if you're not into, if you haven't been into perhaps a humanities education, which how many South Africans have, We're born into these power structures, and it's very difficult to question them, because if they're working okay for you, why would you question them? And I know a lot of women who are like older women, maybe who want to be compliant and want, you know, and want you to, like my own mother, for example, just, you know, be presentable and be ordentlich and be respectable. And that is, for colored women especially, that is where your dignity resides, in being respectable, in making a good life, being a good mother, cooking, that sort of thing. And I mean, I don't want to generalize, and then but certainly that's how I grew up. Let me just speak for myself. And then and you can be educated and all of that, but don't be too out there. That has just been my experience, that I'm, you know, I don't really cook. I cook sometimes, but that was always a problem in my family. And, you know, the mold, if you stay inside the mold, it's safe. And I think safety is a lot of what people are concerned with in South Africa. And, another thing that I've noticed on social media, which also terrifies me, is that people will accuse people of being attention seekers. So it's a way of calling out people. This is in my community. So so the worst thing that someone can say to you is like, oh, you're just an attention seeker. And then I think to myself, you know, what is wrong with wanting it? Like, we all need attention as human beings. It's attention is a form of love. And even as a child, you know, that would be a very derisive thing that people could say to you. Oh, this child is attention seeking, or stop looking for attention. Like, I heard that a lot. And, and even now, when I post things on social media, I think, oh, is this too much? Am I seeking attention? Am I overdoing it? And in this moment, you know, you have to promote your book. It's in your book contract. And I'm thinking,
And then I see
a lot of women academics doing this when they're promoting their writing and their works, are saying, like, shameless self-promotion coming up. It's almost as if we have to couch it and say, oh, sorry for promoting myself. And I've gone way off on the question.
But this is fascinating, but, that apologizing.
Right, so apologizing for, you know, I know I'm – and I thought of writing, I know I'm posting a lot about my book. And then I thought, no, you're not going to do that. Just post about your book and get over it. And whoever's judging me, I know, you know, I feel this so, acutely sometimes, cause even when in my own family, when I see them personally, they'll always talk about, oh, your Facebook, and, they'll reference things that I've posted, but they won't engage with it perhaps on the platform. And this thing of being just visible as a woman and doing things that are risky, because you might get flack for it. It's just a balancing act. And, I think we are conditioned by both men and women to kind of just be in the mold and to be safe in that mold.
Okay. I'm going to turn us to a positive part of women's support now that we're on the topic. You talked to us a little bit before we started recording about the Women's Writing Collective. And you've also talked about at Oxford the support of other writers reading each other's work and giving feedback. That community of writers, talk to us about that and what role that plays for you.
That is so important to me, because when I was doing my PhD in Maryland in the US, it was now 20 years ago. there's this idea of the writer as isolated and lonely and sitting in their room alone. And yes, that is true. And, a lot of most of your work you're going to probably do alone. But I belonged to a group of Black women writers, and we were all doing our PhDs, and we were feeling a bit unsupported and, you know, in the minority in that space. And so we started this group and we would meet on a Saturday morning and, you know, people would come in and out. And that's where I learned the power of just collecting as women. And I've tried to replicate that since then, wherever I am. I try to write in community. So, I'm a big fan of writing retreats. So I create sometimes my own writing retreats and then I will invite people along. So we go for a weekend and it's very informal. It's not a thing where no one gets paid or anything. It's just you book your room and we're at this place and we do it and someone will hold the session and start the session. And sometimes that'll be me. Sometimes that'll be someone else. But generally we've all got a project. We know what we're working on and we're there to work together. And then I've had various writing groups. And I think last year I was part of a writing circle with women and we would meet sometimes a Friday or a Thursday morning and just for an hour and you check in and you just sit and write. And so I'm a huge, huge, huge fan of writing groups. And the different types of writing groups is one like a feedback group where you read each other's work. And there's other things called shut up and write where you just come together, shut up and write. And I think there can be the collective energy of a room humming with people quietly typing is powerful. So I like to create those kinds of situations for myself in which to write because otherwise it does become very lonely. And then you also become cut off from there's something that gets lost. I like to read stuff. And so the Comrade's Wife, for example, my whole writing group read it and one was saying, oh my gosh, no. The sex is just too mulls and boon. Like, are you sure? And so that kind of feedback is really helpful and useful. And
did you change the sex or did you keep mulls and
boon? No, I did.
It's still spicy. I have to tell everyone. It's still spicy.
Toned down a lot. So that kind of, but it's also important. I think I'm, dare I say it, confident enough as a writer also to know when to disregard and when to take on board criticism. Mm-hmm. And I think crucial thing, which Yvette Christiansen, I learned from her, is that you have to have the right people giving feedback because feedback can crush you and it can kill your work if it's the wrong person at the wrong time. Mm. And so to know who to ask and really trust those people and really trust that they have, that they're, like my character says, have your best interest at heart, you know, and, they really care about you and your writing and there's perhaps not even competitiveness or anything like that. But the really honest feedback from someone that you trust is just priceless.
It relates to the power of female friendship, which in Grace, she's quite isolated as a character and she doesn't have a group of women around her and perhaps would have been better off if she had. But in The Comrade's Wife, we see Anita surrounded by strong women friendships, which she draws a lot of strength and a lot of determination from. How important do you think that is?
For writers,
for people
in general. Yes, at every stage of life, I think friendships are so important. And I wrote those characters partly because I wanted to explore different models of womanhood and different relationship configurations. And then also, I think what is important, you know, it's just we valorize romantic love so much in the society. It's like, oh, when you find your partner or your husband or your wife or your forever person. But that's a very powerful form of love to have. And, but friendships and the homosocial friendships, which are just friendship in general. These are often very sustaining types of love that you know, we also go through things with our friends where we maybe fall out or we break up with friends, which, oh my gosh, is there anything more painful than a friend breakup? But generally speaking, if you have good friends, it's really such a powerful antidote to loneliness, to lack of love, to lack of community. And I've just also been reading a lot of literature on our social circles and how strong social networks are so beneficial for your health. Because as you get older, as I'm aging, I'm just really looking at, like, what kind of old person am I going to be? And
we
what is
obsessed,
it?
We are obsessed with that and on how, this podcast.
Because it's about, you know, looking when I'm 70 or 80, what do I want? Because what do I want my life to be like? Because I have to make that life now.
Yes.
And the social part is so incredibly important because it wards off illness, it wards off dementia, all of those things. And I think friendships are just so important. I can't overstate it. So I wanted to show how a strong and healthy and carefully crafted network of friends can really save you when something terrible happens.
Fiona and I are both slightly obsessed exactly with what you're saying. How do you now put in place the things that will create a good and happy and healthy old age? And from what I've read, that friendship aspect is actually one of the big differentiators, that people who have friends and social contact age better, exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, and there's even in my friend circles women, so we're single and we're kind of, well, probably we're not going to get married again or have partners in that particular way. And looking at, I have one friend who's like, let's buy property together as friends and women and somewhere nice. And let's co-live in our, you know, into the 60s or 70s. And I've heard a lot of people talk about that. And it's usually sold as women only spaces, because maybe it's just because women that I'm talking to. But how do we create alternative forms of community when we're living in such a isolating time with, I think it's not so bad in South Africa, but I know people who live in other, like in the UK or in the US, I think it's particularly different there. And here we still have a strong sense of the other and interrelatedness and Ubuntu and those kinds of things. But we're also becoming more and more westernized. And so, you know, it's interesting that women are strategizing about these things.
Okay, I could talk about this all day, so I'm going to force us off the topic. And I'm going to ask you about, you've spoken about that you teach writing. When you are actively teaching writing, do you find it drains the same energy that actually writing takes? Do you have the same energy for your work, or is it a completely different activity?
So generally, I teach a lot. So I'm in the English department at UCT. So we all teach. I like that. So our department, no one gets to not teach. So that's just a core principle, and everyone has to teach, and we do it equitably. So I'm teaching a lot, and teaching, it doesn't matter what kind of teaching it is, because some of the teaching is, I'll teach a novel, like Nervous Conditions, just, and it's not writing. So it takes a lot out of me. I find it quite, when I've taught, I have to go sit down and regroup, and especially large classes. Creative writing teaching, it's different because it's usually, there's no more, my last class is about 20 students, so that's quite small. But then it's a different kind of work because it's more sustained and you have to read constantly what they're handing in, and you've got to give feedback. So they're both types of teaching are very time intensive. And especially then, that is when I'm very meticulous about this is my writing time and I'm not going to intrude on it. So that's when the 5 a.m. starts are really important for me, because then by 7 a.m. I can start my other day. And that's how I get things done. If I didn't wake up at 5 a.m., I don't think I would write. So, and sometimes I'll come back to it in the evening if I have energy, but usually I'm in bed very early. But the teaching takes a lot out of me. And out of every teacher that I know, it does take a lot of energy and creativity, and you're constantly engaging, and then you're seeing, oh, someone's starting to cry or getting upset. And then you have to also tend to them. Yeah. So it's also tending, I think of it. So it does take a lot. And then one has to be very mindful then of your own energy and how you apportion that.
So I just wanted to say that The Comrade's Wife is such a page turner of a book. It's such a quick read. It's such an engrossing and gripping and satisfying read. And I'm wondering, I'm sure you've had feedback that people have enjoyed it so much, but I'm wondering if you've got any pushback, because the antagonist in the novel, not to give anything away, but one of the antagonists in the novel is this unnamed political party, an unnamed movement that Neil devotes a large portion of his life to. And anytime he's away or he's distracted, he says it's the movement, it's the party. I've got to. He's so ambitious. We come to realize that this force is not entirely benevolent. Have you had pushback from people saying, why are you painting essentially the liberation struggle in South Africa in a negative light?
Yeah, I haven't yet. No, it's the book is.
Thank
been
you
out.
For giving people that idea.
You know, obviously that was one of the things that I'm mindful of when I was writing it and wondering, oh, how is this going to land? I haven't had pushback. I've only had positive feedback so far. The book has only been in the world, I think, 2 or 3 weeks now, so people haven't had a lot of time. But also, luckily for me, we're heading to an election. Mm-hmm. So I think people are busy with other things who might be critiquing it. I'm not sure. And I think that may be a fair critique to make, and I'm anticipating it.
How would you push back against it? What would you reply to someone who says, you know, that's not fair game? You can't sort of be so negative about this movement.
I think it is very much fair game. I think there's... we live in a democracy. The contradiction is that the democracy was partly birthed by this movement. Mm-hmm. And it's also a question of how much do we owe, how much allegiance and how much loyalty do we owe it? I think that's something that I've grappled with personally in my life. Mm. As someone who supported the movement very much so, initially, and I think a lot of us have that kind of relationship to it. I think we must, as writers, critique power. What else are we going to do if we don't? I mean, there are many different writers and different types of writers, and there are many different topics, but I think we are in a democracy. The role of the writer for me is if you can't be critical of abuse and the abuse of power, especially. It's just so fundamental. If I can't do that, then what is the use of writing for me? You know, what am I going to write? Love poems.
I'm sure you'd write beautiful love
poems. Which I think love poems are also very important. and I do write love poems sometimes, but, you know, you can't tell a writer, oh, this is off limits. Yes. Once you start going there, that's dangerous. And thank God we're not there in this country. And I do realize the paradox of owing that freedom to that movement, the very same movement that I'm critiquing. So that's a paradox that I think many of us live with.
I love that answer. Okay, Barbara, we always like to ask our guests what they have been reading or watching or listening to lately that's made an impression on them.
Okay, so I am reading many dissertations at the moment. I've read Margie Orford's memoir, Love and Fury. I thought it was so beautifully, beautifully crafted, and what a life. Fascinating. And a lot of points where I could identify with as that pull of motherhood and writing and being creative and wanting your own creative life. I loved Shafinaz Hassim's The Darlings of Durban.
Yes.
And I just loved that novel. It is also very readable. You know, I think she does something really unique with the characters, and I actually want to write about it in a critical way as a literary critic, because she's within a lineage of many Black women writers writing about the so-called ordinary and the everyday and the love and the babies. But there's something very powerful in how she renders the ordinary on the page in this contemporary moment. And I loved that novel. I read a book by Tara Swart. I'm a self-help book addict.
Oh, interesting.
You didn't see that coming.
No.
So this one is called The Source, S-O-U-R-C-E, by Dr. Tara Swart, who I gather has some South African connection, but it's about rewiring your brain, because, you know, there's this, your brain is very plastic, and you can reconfigure how the synapses fire and create, even in your 50s, new pathways, and put down new pathways in your brain to just, again, it's that thing of reflecting on your life and thinking, you know, what do I really want and how do I create the life that I want? I'm very into that, creating the life that I want. And so, you know, that's been my bedside thing that I read every night, just a chapter or two. It's fascinating. And podcasts, I mean, I'm really into health podcasts. I listen to Dr. Chatterjee. And then there's one person, I also listen to menopause podcasts, because I'm menopausal and I need help. So, you know, I'm into health. I love self-help books. I love psychological self-help things. My first book that I read that really spoke to me was the, Scott Peck's, what is that book called now? The Road Less Traveled. And I read it when I was 20, and it really just fundamentally changed my life. So I don't watch things. I don't know why. I don't enjoy watching things.
Mm-hmm.
Strange. But, I saw on the plane. Oh, my gosh, this movie, Sandburn.
Oh, Saltburn.
Saltburn.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Did you see it?
Yes.
And it was so fascinating because I was just at Oxford. I was coming from Oxford and I'm going back to Oxford. So to see that, and I was like, yes, this is exactly the kind of elitism and exclusivity that's how it is. And what a strange movie. I really enjoyed it.
There's one part that is going to live rent-free in my head forever. But
The bath scene,
yes.
Okay, well, I haven't watched this movie and I don't think I'm going to now. I don't want a bath scene living rent-free in my head.
That imagination that came up with that.
Yeah. Well, Barbara, we hope that everyone checks out Grace, a novel, which is still available and can be acquired directly from Majaji Books, and also The Comrade's Wife, which is an absolute cracker of a page turner and so, so satisfying. It's out now from Jacana, and we wish you all the best with it, and thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this.
Gail, I'm so happy we had Barbara Boswell as our first guest of the new season. That was really inspiring and so, so interesting.
It really was. I am feeling that energy about writing. She had an energy about her that you just feel how much joy she takes in her writing. I am feeling so inspired.
What in particular struck you about what she said?
So I was very interested in what she said about not having distractions when you write.
Oh, yes, looking at a blank wall.
Looking at a blank wall. And I think that this is possibly something I need to think about very, very carefully. I have so many distractions when I write, the distractions of my job, the distractions of my children, the distractions of the cats who sit watching me while I write. And I maybe need to have a careful look about which of those distractions can I get rid of. And maybe it is something simple like making my space a bit less distracting. So I'm going to think about that very carefully. What about you, Fiona?
Well, I was so interested because this is not something that I've ever done, but she talked a lot about using writing workshops and writing retreats as a way of stimulating her creativity and how she created a writing workshop herself, and it's still going on. And sometimes it's just a shut up and write, and sometimes it's a sort of guided session. And I'm actually writing about a writing retreat at the moment, and I've never been on one. And I'm just wondering, could this be a source of creativity for me, either now or in the future? Because I've always just been that very, very solo writer. I've never felt the need to be part of that community.
I have also never been on a retreat, and I imagine it must be magical. Think about what we get out of doing the podcast. Think about what we get out of going to the festivals. And I think then you're in that space where you're getting that enrichment, but you also have made a special space for your writing. I am very hungry to become a writing retreat person.
I think we're getting to a time in our lives when this could be possible for us.
So Fiona, let's imagine you're starting your writer's retreat. What piece of advice do you have for writers this week?
Well, it's very specific to what I was talking about earlier, which is I've been struggling to keep my writing going in the midst of a lot of travel, a lot of festivals, distractions, etc. And I would say don't overlook the superpower of the aeroplane because it's also – it's that – undistracted space that you were talking about. It's the blank wall. Your phone doesn't work. There's no point in checking your WhatsApps because there haven't been any. There's nothing to look at except the back of the seat in front of you. Nobody wants to chat on an airplane, so you're not being distracted in that way. People bring you coffee and food, and there's really nothing to do except get your writing done. And I've had a few plane trips lately, and I've just used those couple of hours to get my words done. And I know I can relax. I've got a plane journey coming up. The writing will get done. So my advice is don't overlook the magic of a plane journey.
I'm getting on a plane this evening, so perhaps your advice is well timed.
What about you, Gail?
So we cover in this podcast, we mention writing books a lot, which books different people have found useful for writing. And it's something I get asked about a lot. What books do you suggest for writers? I'm sure you are as well. And I thought, let me put my list together today to start the season. Four books that I recommend. The first we've mentioned many times on this podcast, On Writing by Stephen King.
Yes,
whether
always.
Or not you like his writing, you have to read that book. If you haven't, just turn the podcast off right now and go and read that book and then come back to it. The other one that I love, Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott. I love The Getaway Car by Ann Patchett. And a bit of a unusual one, people don't talk about it as much, but Elizabeth George, who writes lovely English murdery detail books, has written one that was the first writing book I read, and maybe that's why I love it. But hers is called Right Away, and it's got some really practical, like there's a chapter on characters, there's a chapter on scene setting. It's really practical advice. I love that book, and the piece of advice I remember about it from that book the most is when you name your character, naming them badly can stop you writing.
Ah, okay.
Sometimes you're stuck because you've given them the wrong name. It's proven true for me. So those are the books that I recommend.
Okay, well, I've only read On Writing out of those four, so I think I need to get on with the other three. And in the meantime, we hope everybody checks out Grace, a Novel by Barbara Boswell. It's still available from Majaji Books. Contact them directly. They will hook you up. And in all bookstores at the moment is The Comrade's Wife, published by Jacana. It's a really great read, and we think you should check it out. And we would particularly like it if you have a specific question about writing, writing process, or anything that you are stuck on. Please drop us a message on Facebook, drop us a tweet, contact us on Threads, on Instagram, send us an email. We would be very happy to answer any of your questions. We'll deal with one or two questions a week, and please get in touch. We'd love to hear from you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.